Welcome to Energy Matters, exploring awakening to your authentic self and finding purpose through mind, body, and soul. With your hosts, Cody Edner and David Gandelman. Brought to you by intuitivevision.net and groundedmind.com.
Hey, Energy Matters listeners. Welcome back to another show of Energy Matters. I am here, as always, with my esteemed co-host, David Gandelman.
Hello, hello. I'm very esteemed today. I just got out of the esteemed room, and I'm dripping with it. Good to be here.
It's good to be esteemed.
It is.
Hey, we are very excited to bring to you today the author of Big Love, The Power of Living with a Wide Open Heart, Scott Stabile. And he has a fascinating story. His story really is one of moving through tragedy to transformation to wholeness. And he is sharing that story with us today. His story really began at age 14, I think it was. His parents were murdered. And beyond having to deal with that, he lost his brother to a heroin overdose about 9 years after that. And then he got involved in a cult for many years, was kind of in a very isolated, insulary way of living. And he's come out of that, and he shared his story with us. And really, his story kind of comes to a point about finding that place within ourselves of being able to live in our heart and love. So,
and forgive, yeah.
And forgive. That maybe was one of the biggest challenges among many. So, great to have you all here today. Look forward to sharing this with you. Hope you enjoyed as much as we did. Let's get to it. Scott Stabile, everybody.
All right. So, hey, Energy Matters listeners, welcome back. We've got an amazing guest today, Scott Stabile. He's coming to us from Michigan, outside of Detroit. And first of all, welcome, Scott. So good to have you here.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Yeah. Welcome, Scott.
And at the time of this recording, I'm in Costa Rica and Cody's in Colorado. So we're all over the place. It's good to get together. And we've been having a good laugh for the last 10 minutes. I'm going to record that for you all, but we'll have some more. And so Scott, last few days, Cody and I have been like reading through your book, Big Love, and through some watching your YouTube videos and all your Facebook stuff. And you've got quite a message and quite a story. And I'm sure you've told this story so many times, but you've been through incredible hardship from your parents being murdered when you were a teenager to your brother, you know, overdosing on heroin to being in a cult for years, which we definitely want to ask you about what that was like and how you got out of it. Welcome back.
Yeah. Everybody wants to know about the cult, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, me and Cody kind of want to start one. So we're just wondering, like, what do you need?
Yeah, of course. I'll give you tips. There's a checklist.
What's the registration form look like?
Mind control is the first thing on the checklist.
All right, we'll get into the mind control techniques with Scott. One of the things I was wondering, Scott, was, you know, so many people go through suffering, but not everybody comes out of it the other side. So I guess like happy and jovial and accepting and loving as you are, from what I could tell from talking with you already. What's your secret? How did you take so much suffering and pain and transmute it or transform it into love? How did you do that?
You know, I would say at the time when I lost my parents, which was at 14, they were shot to death. Mm-hmm. I don't think I did anything consciously. You know, when I reflect back on that time in my life, I'm incredibly grateful that something in me knew to just bury that experience. And that's what I did. I locked it away, really. I would have a good cry once a year. Mm-hmm. But outside of that, it was like I never brought it up. I never talked about it. It was a big secret. I moved to a new school and no one knew about my parents. If conversations started to focus on family, I would manipulate them away from anything that could lead to anyone asking me about my family and my parents. And that's how I survived it at the time. And it's interesting because the first chapter of the book, I talk about this experience and I talk about it in the context of not burying our pain. And that the only way I found to really open myself up to the fullness of my life and the fullness of connections with other people is when I'm being present with what's going on for me, when I'm allowing myself to sit in my sadness, to sit in my grief, to sit in my anger, to sit in whatever is going on. Mm-hmm. Because when we put walls up, in my experience, we put walls up to everything. We can't really be selective. I can't really decide, I'm just going to have a wall up to everything that hurts, you know, but not to everything that's glorious and beautiful and lovely. You know, that's not how energy
works.
We can't
do that. Damn.
Well, I can. Maybe you can. And if you can, then you're going to have a cult, no problem. Just teach
me. I'm going to have
that.
A book called Big Love and Big Walls.
Yeah, exactly. Keep your walls and get all the love anyway.
Only but, two people get in, the ones that, that don't hurt me.
But I mean, so, but I, when I reflect back on being a teenager, I'm so grateful that I buried it for so many years, because I think some part of me knew that I couldn't handle it. I couldn't survive it in a way that would allow me to move forward in my life and still make good choices. You know, I was a straight A student, had lots of friends and went to a good college. And I think all of that happened in part because I didn't allow myself to really sit in the grief around my parents. And then in my 20s, I started to recognize that love is what's powerful in this world, is what is most powerful. And that I want to be operating from the energy of love as often as possible. And that when I'm doing so, I stand to create the best possible life for myself. And I also stand to contribute most positively to the people in my life and to the world around me. So I just started really, really rooting myself in love. And that is what's changed my life. You know, when I started to be present in the energy of love, I also started to recognize that, like, I can sit in my grief and I'm going to be okay. Mm-hmm. I can rage about what happened to my parents. And in my 20s is when I really started to feel the emotional toll of that. It's when I really allowed myself to cry more than once a year and to rage and to just feel whatever it was I was feeling. And I think only when we allow ourselves to feel do we see that we're able to be with whatever emotions are coming our way. Mm-hmm. I think some part of my mind was afraid I couldn't handle it. Like, I couldn't face losing my parents and the way I lost them. I wouldn't be able to survive it. I think that's what I, on a subconscious level, I was feeling. And the only way we know that we can survive is if we allow ourselves to be present with whatever it is we're afraid will take us down, right?
And was there a moment, right, Scott, where, like, was there a moment in your 20s where there was just like a pinnacle breakthrough? Was when, how did that realization come about? Did, you know, for some of us, we're like waiting for this one big moment, or was it kind of a small moment followed by many hundreds or thousands of other moments? What was the, you know, what was the process like?
I think a couple things. I think one, there was a meltdown moment where, you know, I would literally cry once a year. It was like clockwork. And like have this meltdown cry, then get back to my life. Well, around 20, probably 22, 23, I had the meltdown cry, except it didn't stop. I was living in San Francisco at the time. I had just moved there after college. Yes, so I was about 22 years old. And for several days, I just was locked in my room, crobbing. That's crying and sobbing together. I was crobbing all over the place.
I love that. We coined a new word.
But just crying and crying. And I thought, okay, I've lost my mind now. Like, this isn't, there's no way out of this. So I pulled out a phone book, which we had at the time, and literally flipped to the yellow pages, to the psychoanalyst section, closed my eyes, pointed at a name and called this woman.
Wow.
And it was really one of those moments. Like, I felt like, I don't know what to do. Like, I was, I was at the end, not at the end in the sense of I was considering suicide, at the end in the sense of, like, I didn't see a way out of that misery and that darkness. Like, I thought a switch had flipped and I'd like gone off the deep end, you know, like lost it all. So I called this woman, and I went and saw her for 6 weeks, once a week, because that's all I could afford at the time, and just talked about my parents and cried about them, and it grounded me. And I think that, as far as an experience in my life, I think that experience showed me, talking with her once a week and crying about it and all of that stuff, it showed me you can be with this. You're strong enough to be with this. It's okay to feel this. So that was profound, because something in me like was like, okay, I can feel, I can cry. It's okay. I'm going to come out of it again and be present in the world and cry again and come, you know what I mean? And then at the same time, I got a job at this store, this kind of new age world gift store. And it had an amazing book section with all these metaphysical books. And this was my first time even hearing the word enlightenment, let alone reading about it and reading about, you know, meditation and being surrounded by people who had love and peace as a goal in their life beyond a career path, you know? And so I was awakening to this whole new way of being, you know, at the same time that I was grieving my parents in a different way. And it culminated in this understanding of like, just be real with what's going on for you and return to love of yourself, return to love of other people. And when I speak about love, I'm speaking about all that love invites, like compassion and empathy and kindness and forgiveness. It's like, keep coming back to those energies and see what gifts they have to offer you in your life.
Mm. Is there a book in this bookstore, a specific book?
There were a lot of books. I mean, at the time I was like, Way of the Peaceful Warrior was one of the first books that I read in the 90s, you know, and my book is published by that publisher now, which is
really
cool. New World Library published that book, and they published The Power of Now, which is another book that had a big impact on me, you know, later. And, there was a book called The Mutant Message that I loved. It was about a woman who went on a walkabout with an Aboriginal tribe, and it was another book that was really a call to presence and to the power that we have to create our lives. The Celestine Prophecy was, I was reading them all, you know, and they were all for me so new. I'd never read books like this. All triggered something positive.
Isn't it so cool when that first happens and you open up the Celestine Prophecy and you're like, what the? Your head's like,
Yes. Conversations with God was for me a huge one also. It was like, oh my God, this all, it was like coming home to something that you'd never experienced before and finding these tools and resources that were all making a lot of sense. It was like, yes, I get this. This resonates. This feels right. This feels true.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great. You know, I had an experience about age 12 that resonates with kind of where you lost your parents and then maybe got kind of distanced from your friends. So I had my very best friend in the world when I was 12. I went away one summer and then was coming back to school the next year. And over that summer, his mother disappeared. And the assumption was she was murdered. And the feeling was that his father did it. So he lost his mom. They never found her, so we don't know really what happened, but he lost his mom and his dad in that summer. And then trying to reconnect or even connect with him in school after that was, you know, I didn't know how to handle it at age 12. I didn't know how to communicate to him. I didn't know how to relate. And ultimately, he got moved away to a different school, but we never really reconnected after that. But how do we go about kind of breaking through those kind of walls? I mean, at age 12, I wouldn't expect someone to be able to, but in present time, you know, what happened for you in terms of relationships and were there people that helped you or just what do you find on that topic? And how do we break through those kinds of walls of either something that's very taboo or pain, so deeply painful, you know?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I mean, I think one thing we can do is just be present for people. I think that so often when we don't know what to say, when there are no words and we don't know what to say, it's very easy to energetically distance ourselves from people going through something really tough because we feel like there's no way for us to show up the right way. And so a lot of people will choose not really to show up at all. And I think that people I did have friends and support. I'm not suggesting that this was the case for me. At 14, it's really tricky. I mean, it's tricky at any time if you go through something like this, but my experience was one of the reasons I kept it such a secret is because I knew that my experience was overwhelming for people, like it was for you probably to experience what your friend had gone through. And I couldn't handle people being overwhelmed. Like, I was already dealing with enough, as I saw it on my end, that like putting that information on others and then having to feel their overwhelm and having to try to make them feel better about what they're feeling about what right. I'm feeling, it just was too much, which is why I created a big secret around it, I think, in part. And I also didn't want to feel be pitied by yeah. people who knew me, because that never felt really good. But I think what we can let people know who are dealing with deep loss or grief or whatever it is, it's like, hey, I'm here. I don't, we can even saying the words like, I don't know what to say right now. I don't have any words that I feel will serve you necessarily, but I'm here. And just knowing that a person's there and their presence and they're showing up, they're reaching out, they're checking in. I think that goes a long way for people, you know?
Right.
And I look at my life now, and I mean, my parents died. I'm 46, you know, so that was 32 years ago. But I look at other things I've gone through since then, or when I'm having a really hard time, and just having people in my life who are like sending sweet texts. I love you. I'm thinking about you. I'm here. That helps. It helps a lot. Yeah.
Feeling that consideration and care from others.
Because we all have been there. We all don't. I have friends going through things right now, and I never feel like I have the right words to offer.
Right.
You know, but I can offer my presence.
Yeah. It's strange. That just this morning, Scott, I was teaching a retreat, a group, and I guided everyone through a meditation. And I kind of went around the room, just asked a couple of people, how was that for you? And there was this one gentleman, he's never done a yoga meditation retreat before. You know, I thought he was in just a lot of resistance, like, oh, I hope this goes okay for him meditating. And he just, today's day two, and he just broke down and broke through. And his best friend just died, 33 years old, of cancer. And when he said it out loud, it just like the dam broke. And the whole group was just there, just kind of, and I, you know, I'm the teacher, right? So I'm there kind of holding space as he is expressing himself. And also looking for words, like, what can you say to somebody at that moment when that's happened? And so I just let him, you know, communicate for a while. And what came out of him was an immense amount of anger. He said he had been angry at the whole world, at his friends, for weeks since this happened, just really angry. And then we explored the anger and noticed that under the anger was the grief. So often, I think often in the grieving process, you know, shock and denial and anger come first.
Yeah.
And then when that kind of starts to move, then the grief can have space. The anger tends to come first. Did you find yourself being angry or in denial? What was the grieving process for you like? And do you have advice for people who are going through a grieving process, like how to handle each stage of it?
For me, I feel like the real grieving process didn't come until years later in my 20s. And it felt like a lot of it at once. I do see anger as a more superficial emotion, like what you're saying. And I think not just in grief, almost in every area of life, underneath anger, there's usually sadness, you know, when you start digging. Yeah. I think for people grieving, if there's one thing I would encourage, it's just to not feel like there's any one way to do it. You know, I think that we're taught that there are these stages of grief, and maybe for some there are, but I think to suggest that there's like seven exact stages and we all go through them in a very specific order is to do it. Yeah, exactly. The 21-day plan to grief. I think that we do a disservice to people, because then what we're saying, we're setting them up to fail. And that's the last thing you need to be thinking about, is that you're grieving wrong. You know, you could be circling back through anger and denial, whatever, 10 different times, 20 different times, and that's okay. You know, I think that however people are grieving is okay.
So the one, back.
Yeah, again, it's been more than 3 decades, and I by no means am grieving daily or regularly about my parents. That's not the reality I'm living in now. And there are moments where something might get triggered and I will like go right into the feelings of sadness about losing them. You know, it'll come back up again, which I've become much more adept at feeling my feelings than I used to be. And I really welcome the opportunity to cry and to be sad if that's what's really going on for me, you know? So to anyone out there grieving, grieve however you need to grieve, and also know that nothing lasts forever. I mean, the mantra, "This too shall pass," is one of my favorites, and I think it's been around and for a reason, because it's true. You know, nothing does last forever. Even our greatest griefs, we figure out a way to, they integrate into our lives. And it doesn't mean that we're ever over the person necessarily, or that we found closure. I think that's another false concept, the idea that we can just wrap things up nicely and have closure. If you lose someone who's dear to your life, I don't think you ever find this perfect closure around it. I think you figure out a way to integrate that loss into your life in a way that allows you to move forward, you know? Mm-hmm. So I don't think anything lasts forever, including like the worst of it. Like, you might be grieving right now and feeling like there's never any light that's going to come again. And there is, you know, that's the nature of life.
Mm. Wow. That's beautiful. Thank you, Scott, for that. And probably everyone listening who's grieving or been through grief or maybe processed a part but didn't process the other part. Yeah. Don't be so hard on yourself.
Yeah, not at all.
And tell us about writing, Scott. So I was looking at your schedule and it looks like you travel and teach a lot of writing workshops. So are you using writing as a form of processing grief? Yeah.
Okay. I'm using writing as a form of processing everything. Writing is an incredible tool. You know, that's the writing workshop I'm doing right now called Writing Yourself. It's really not about writing at all. It's really in terms of like creative writing. It's not about technique. It's not about grammar. It's not about putting a book together. It's really about using writing as a tool for self-discovery and self-exploration. And it's an amazing tool in that way, because what I've found is that, you know, we all have crazy human minds and we can all get lost in the mice on the wheel spinning around over, you know, whatever it is we're obsessing over today, you know, whatever it is we're feeling angry or blameful about or fearful about. Those things are just, we just circle back through them. And what I found that when we actually put a pen to paper and write through some of those things that we're thinking about or feeling about, that we find ourselves going to different places that we often don't get to when we're just thinking about it. That's one of the amazing things I've noticed about writing, is that when I sit down to write as a tool for processing, I actually get from A to B to C to D to E to F a lot. When I'm just thinking, a lot of times I just get A to A to A to A, you know what I mean? It's just that spinning. Yeah. So that's one of the great things. And I integrate writing exercises that I know from my own experience will help people call upon things within themselves that bring stuff up. So I'm a big fan of writing.
So even if you just... What's a good writing prompt for someone who's grieving? Is there like a specific writing prompt that you give them?
For someone who's grieving? No, I mean, more than a specific prompt, I would just encourage people to write down whatever it is they're feeling. If you are, I mean, for someone who's grieving, they're definitely dealing with sadness. They're definitely dealing with anger. They're often dealing with blame. So I would say I am angry because, and start there and let the floodgates of their rage open up. You know, I am sad right now because, I am hurt right now, I am blameful right now because. You can start very simply like that, and that if you allow yourself to go into that feeling, you can write for days, especially if you're grieving. You know what I mean?
Right.
I miss X right now because... You know, go into your missing of the person, you know, whatever it is that you're feeling, write it down, explore it in that way.
Interesting. And so when you teach these workshops, are you writing most of the time and then sharing? What does it look like?
It looks like a mix. I talk a lot, but just because I can talk. Yeah. I give exercises. I give specific exercises. People will write. I'll share anecdotal stories that connect to whatever theme we're discussing. You know, we work on themes of identity, empathy, compassion, fear. And then people will share if they want. They don't have to, but often people will want to share, which will lead to more discussion. People will ask questions. You know, I'll respond to the questions from my experience. And it ends up feeling, they're really beautiful. They're really intense. You know, they just are. It's the nature of this kind of, when people come to my workshops, they some part of them is coming because they want to look at themselves more honestly and they want to heal. So when you have people showing up for their own growth and healing, it's going to be intense. But when I say intense, I thrive on intensity like that. It's right. Beautiful. You know, it's people like showing up to be honest with themselves and to do the work of healing. So we all sit in a circle. It's usually about 20 of us and we get to work, you know, and we hold space for one another. And what's also beautiful is that the people who come often leave like exchanging numbers and, you know, small tribes and communities are built because there are people like other open-hearted souls. You know, it's beautiful. Right. I love it. It's one of my favorite things to do.
Yeah, that's great. So it seems like love and what we've been talking about all kind of comes around to like reconnection, maybe with ourselves is the core thing, like moving through grief or pain or some kind of an overwhelming level of emotion. In that reconnection, how does shame fit in? I mean, I know a lot of us kind of are disconnected around kind of the energy of shame. And whether we got shamed growing up or there's certain things we've been told in our world that aren't okay, where it's something not that's happened to us so much, but something that's wrong with us as the perception, right? What are your thoughts about moving through the vibration of shame, or how does someone kind of break through that particular wall?
Shame's a bitch.
I like that answer. Yeah.
Shame is bitch.
Isn't it? And,
yes. Is it okay to say bitch?
Yes, it is.
Like, I call Cody that all the time.
You know, we're all dealing with shame, every human being on the planet. And the only way I've found to successfully move through my shame is to announce it. You know, because shame thrives in secrecy. You know, it depends on us feeling so ashamed of ourselves about this or that, whatever it is, that we'll never make it public to anybody. And that's where it holds all of its power. So I know that it's not easy to announce our shame. There's a reason we're not, because we feel embarrassed and disgusted or whatever in ourselves. Because shame is telling us, like you said, it's guilt is like, oh, I've done something wrong. I'm feeling guilty about it. Shame is telling us that we are wrong, that we are fundamentally flawed, and that there's something wrong with us. And that's a very painful, painful belief to internalize. But as we all know, you guys and all of your listeners and watchers, is that the moment we announce that thing that we feel ashamed of to a close friend, a confidant, to a therapist, to a support group, the power of the shame dissipates. Mm-hmm. And the only practice I've experienced, and I know that getting to that point isn't easy, but there are a lot of resources out there. If there's something you feel really ashamed of, I can guarantee you, you're not alone in your shame. There are thousands or millions of us who feel that shame as well. And we live at a time where there are so many resources, online resources, there are so many groups and meetups, that we actually do have access to others who are probably dealing with something very similar. And if you're not ready to announce it, at the very least, find others out there who are out there dealing with it and who are announcing it. You know, my greatest shame was my sexuality and coming to terms with being a gay guy. And that wasn't something I came to terms with in my youth. I felt horrific shame about it, which kept me in the closet. But then suddenly what you start to do is you start to realize that when you announce that to somebody, the only way you can get to the Me Too, the only way you can get to the experience of realizing you're not alone, is if you share what you're going through. You know what I'm saying? And maybe it's going to be just one person you can share that with to begin with. And that person is going to either offer a me too or tell you you're not alone or tell you, oh, I don't care, I love you anyway. Like, this doesn't matter. But you can't have that reality until you find the courage to announce whatever it is you're ashamed of. And maybe you won't find the courage until you start to really do your research and see, I am one of many. And the reason I use writing in this workshop to process pain too, because I encourage people to write out their shame, the thing that they're most ashamed of. Write it out. How has it affected your life? Because, and do it every day if you have to. It's not a fun exercise for people to write out their shame, by the way.
No way.
But yeah. When you're writing it every day, you're going to get bored. You're going to get so bored of your shame. It's going to lose some of its power. It's going to lose some of its weight. Mm-hmm. And that might get you to the point where you can call up your closest friend and say, hey, I've been sitting on this for my whole life, and I'd like to share this with you now. You know, and I encourage you to, like, I'm someone who shares a lot, and I know, like, people are really judgmental in general. We're all judgmental. And I don't encourage people to share that most shameful thing with someone they feel might judge them for it, because that's a really bad experience. If you're finally to the place of being courageous enough to share your shame and someone's judging you, you know, maybe it's going to be a therapist first, who's non-judgmental, or maybe you're going to reach out to someone you know is going through what you're going through, and they're not going to judge you because they're going through it and they're putting it out there for the world to see. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know another way besides announcing it in some way.
Yeah.
Announce it.
Announce it. Your shame controls you. Our secrets own us. You know, our shame owns us if we're not willing to just move beyond it.
That's incredible, incredible advice. Absolutely.
But it's not easy. I say these things and I don't mean to suggest it's easy at all in any way. And I also don't mean to suggest that, like, I've announced everything. Do you know what I mean? Right. I announce a lot in Big Love, you know, and it scared the shit out of me. When the book was about to be released, I got really nervous. I'm like, oh my God, I put so much out there. Like,
now, of yourself, right?
Of myself.
It's like an honest expression and of just essays about yourself, right?
Yeah, my insecurities, my pain, all of it, my shame, all of it. But I also knew that, I mean, there are a few things as freeing as just being honest with who you are, you know? Mm-hmm. Because when you're honest with who you are, you know, people are going to judge you no matter what. They're going to judge you whether you're allowing yourself to fall prey to all the conditioning that's been put on you since the time you were a child, or they're going to judge you whether you're living the most honest version of yourself. So I encourage people to just live your truth. Knowing you're going to be judged no matter what you do, why wouldn't you live your truth? Because in your truth lives your freedom, you know? And in your truth lives an invitation for others to live their truth as well.
Wow.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. And that writing it out every day until it gets boring and the energy of its seriousness and drains off is incredible advice.
And think about the times you've shared something you felt ashamed of. Like, losing my hair, I lost it at an early age. I lost it in my first year of college, started really going bald, kept a hat on for 3 years straight. Never let anyone see the top of my head. Put so much energy into hiding that. And when I reflect back on that, even in my 20s, when I would look back, I'm like, oh my, it's so silly. Like, so often the things that we feel are these heavily weighted things, they end up looking so silly in our eyes because they are usually. And also, people don't care as much about the things we're upset. They're so obsessed with their own lives and their own stories. They don't have time to put so much energy into how much hair I have. You know,
That's interesting. I don't think you're the only guy to have gone through that.
Yeah.
No, every man who loses his hair goes through it on some level, you know? And you're lucky, Cody.
Yeah. You're so lucky, Cody, you bastard.
Yeah.
So let's get to blame.
You full head of hair, son of a bitch.
You think you're better than us?
Yeah.
You know. So now we move to blame.
To blame. What do you want? You want to talk about blame?
Let's talk a little bit about blame, because definitely, you know, this movement inward to deal with whether it's shame, pain, loss, fear, whatever. Blame is like the projection away from that, right? Yeah, outward. Yeah. And how do we break through that kind of a cycle or recognize if we're caught up in that? Because it really only hurts us, right? If we're the ones stuck in blame.
Absolutely. Blame serves nothing and no one positively.
Right.
Period. I mean, the way to move beyond it is to stop blaming. Really, to recognize, like, one, when you recognize that every time you're blaming someone else for your circumstances, you're giving away your power, period. Because in blaming someone else, I'm giving them my power. I'm saying that they have enough power to impact my life in a way that I don't have a say in what's happening for me. The moment I stop blaming, and that's not to say that we haven't all been on the receiving end of horrific actions and victim to horrific actions in our life or you know, bad stuff. But choosing to live in that space is choosing to live in the past. Blame is of the past, period. When you're in the present moment, when you're taking ownership of your life as it is right now, no matter what you've been through in your past, there's absolutely no space for blame. You know, and that's how we can move forward empowered to create whatever kind of life we want to live, rather than being like, you know, I hate you because you did this and you ruined my life. No, that's just not true. Doesn't matter what anybody does to you. I don't mean to speak about it lightly, because again, people have been abused and beaten, and there have been a lot of horrific things done to people. It's not about that. It's about owning this moment now. I have been through this and this and this and this, and here I am in this present moment with ownership over my life. I will not waste my energy blaming other people and giving them the power. You know, and it's just about awareness. I think, honestly, Cody, I think everything is about awareness. It's like the moment you see yourself blaming someone else is the moment you're aware of it is the moment you can stop doing it and say, okay, that person was an asshole. That person did a bad thing. And here I am right now. How do I want to move forward?
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Blame serves nothing.
Right. And it's kind of like a victim mentality. If you tell someone, well, don't be a victim, it's not saying that they haven't been victimized or that we don't get victimized. It's saying that mentality doesn't serve you to be empowered moving forward, right?
Absolutely.
It's not to diminish the horrific things that happen in the world. It's to take our power back from them and say, well, regardless of that, I'm here now. What am I going to do now?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's where our power lives. And then I feel like in talking about blame, for me, I think what helps people move beyond blame is also finding empathy, is also really connecting to the humanity in another person, actually putting yourself in their shoes, trying to imagine what their experience might have been like, what might their life have been like that led them to do that thing that they did that was so horrible. Because when we can show up to relationships with people from a place of empathy and with compassion in our hearts, it helps us find forgiveness for their actions. And when we reach forgiveness, which I believe is one of the harder mandates of love, I mean, like, love tells us to be kind. That's easy for a lot of us. Love tells us to forgive. That is not easy for any of us. You know what I mean? But I believe I operate from a place of forgiveness because I believe love says forgive. So without conditions, you know, so I'm committed to forgiving without conditions. And when we find our way to that forgiveness, or even the empathy first and the compassion next, it's harder to blame. We just don't operate in that space. They're functioning in totally different energy fields. You know, and when you're coming with empathy and compassion, it's like you don't think of blame. It's not what comes to you, you know. But it takes work. It takes conscious work. Like every time you're in the blameful place, can you go to empathy? Empathy is a practice state. Just put yourself in the other person's shoes. Imagine what their experience is like, you know.
Yeah. That's great.
Essentially what we're talking about, Scott, is relationship. And so when it comes to maybe intimate relationship, and you talk about, so your kind of concept of love is the umbrella of every type of love and the way it extends out through compassion, forgiveness. What about the individual, like one-on-one love with another person? How did you find that developed for you when you started to recognize how much you hadn't grieved, and when you started moving through the pain, How did that affect your relationships? And is it necessary to go through all that stuff to get through the layers to have a healthy relationship?
I'll say yes and no, because my experience of the more work I do on myself, the more honest I become with myself, the more willing I am to look at my darkness as well as my light, the deeper my relationships with people naturally come. You know, anytime you're showing up to your life from a deeper, more authentic place, you're going to invite deeper connection with people. That's not to say that you can't have beautiful relationships with people, even if you're not doing the intense work of healing. You know, I think that, you know, there are people out, we're all having lovely relationships if we're having them. I just think that the more you work on yourself, the deeper those relationships become naturally. And also the more you work on yourself, the more likely you are to lose some of your relationships naturally. And which is also a part of, well, I mean, that's such a, that's such a gloom and doom statement.
I'm not working on myself anymore.
Yeah. Not everybody's going to cheerlead your growth. And I'm sure you both have experienced this in your life. You know, it's when we're growing, when we're healing, when we're getting more honest with who we are, that is provocative to some. It can be provocative to some who don't want to face themselves in an authentic and real way, who also want to keep you boxed into the David and the Cody that they know you to be. And the moment you start to reflect on yourselves and do healing work, you're going to start edging out of that box. You know, you're going to start to grow and into something greater than the person you've been conditioned to be your whole life. And when that happens, it provokes people, and not everyone's going to cheerlead it. Many will. I'm not suggesting that you're going to lose all your friends. You know, I'm incredibly close with my family. I have friends that I've had for many, many years, and some friendships have gone in different directions, which will happen anyway. When we're adults, your friendships go in different directions, even if you're not doing healing work. But the beauty of that is, you know, is that you also start to magnetize different people. You start to magnetize people who are meeting you on a deeper level, who are willing to be more vulnerable in your connections with them. And those type of relationships for me are the most fulfilling. The ones where people will show up and be like, this is what's going on for me. This is who I am. And willing to say to me, I see you and I love you for who you are. Because isn't that what we want in our relationships with people?
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah, to be seen, to be felt. To know that somebody else
and accepted.
And accepted. Yeah. But all that happens on a deeper level when we're able to bring that to ourselves on a deeper level. That's what I feel like how I'm showing up for myself directly corresponds with how the world is showing up for me. I've seen this over and over and over again. And that doesn't mean that every time, like I'm in love with myself and I'm going out into the world feeling groovy, that everyone's going to be smiling at me and adoring me. It doesn't mean that. But in general, energy attracts like energy. That's just the nature of how energy works, you know? So how are you showing up for yourself? Are you showing up with love when you wake up in the morning and you're looking in the mirror? Are you abusing yourself? Are you calling yourself ugly and stupid and fat and too this and not enough this or whatever it else we're all saying to ourselves in the mirror? The moment you have awareness of that self-abusive talk, interrupt it and offer yourself some love. You know, comment on your what's beautiful about you. You know, that's the work. I think that's the work of healing, is the awareness and following up the awareness with positive action that supports your well-being and supports your self-love and function. Go out into the world with that, and you're going to find that people are going to show up with a lot more love for you as well.
So it's awareness and action.
Yeah. Awareness alone. If I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm beating up on myself again, but I don't do anything about it, then I'm just beating up on myself. You know what I mean?
You're just aware of that fact.
You're just aware of it. But like, what can I do differently? And that's, I really believe people have tools. Mm-hmm. We intuitively know, and you guys do a lot around intuition. So it's like, I believe we intuitively know what we need to do to take care of ourselves. It's, and that it's about doing it. You know, it's like once we start figuring out the tools that work for us, like I love walks in the trees. I know that if I make time to take a walk outside amongst trees in nature, I am serving myself and my well-being in a very positive way. I know that. So am I taking the time to do it?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We know it.
What does your day look like, Scott? Do you sit and meditate every day? Do you make sure you exercise? How does somebody take the action?
I'm only laughing because I don't do anything every day. But when I'll tell you what, lately how I have been starting my days, and it helps me so much move into the day in a positive way. I like to start my day with gratitude most days. Like when I wake up and I start recounting things I'm grateful for immediately because it sets a completely different, open, beautiful tone to my day. And then lately I've been doing like a 20 to 30 minute yoga routine that this Ayurvedic practitioner gave me, followed by like 10 minutes of meditation. I am not an adept meditator. I know it's good for me and I still am resistant to it. But even when I sit for 10 minutes and if 9.5 of those minutes are spent in this busy mind, it still serves me. I still come out of a meditation feeling like I just gave something positive to myself.
Yeah.
You know? And now that I live in Michigan and we've had like the winter that will never end, but finally something has shifted and I'm getting outside every day and just taking walks in my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And that serves me.
And so Scott, you've written this awesome book at which I want to mention that Elizabeth Gilbert, the author of Eat, Pray, Love, has said some very nice things about you.
I know. That was a surprise and delight for me.
So I'm going to read it. She said, Scott is a wonderful presence of love, advocacy, warmth, resilience, and grace in our world. I adore and admire everything he creates. That is a hell of an endorsement.
Yeah, that is.
I had no idea Elizabeth Gilbert was aware of anything I created. So, and I am a huge, huge fan of hers, not just of her writing, which I love, but of her presence in the world. She is doing so much good. She's such a wise, loving human being.
She's got so much depth. Yeah. It's clear from watching her interviews.
Yeah.
So, now you have to live up to Elizabeth Gilbert.
No pressure.
No problem. Yeah. I can do it.
Well, you can write the male version of Eat, Pray, Love.
Yeah. Thank you for the kind things you said about my book, by the way. I appreciate it.
Really, really great book. And before we forget, at scottstabile.com, and your Facebook page seems like where you interact mostly with people. You have hundreds of thousands of people following you on there and liking your stuff. You've built quite the audience and the community. It looks like a community that you've created for people.
Yeah, it's been great. Find me on Facebook if you're on Facebook. And I'm also doing more with Instagram now, like live videos there too. And those communities are wonderful because it's a place for me and I think for the people who are showing up there of just a constant reminder that you are not alone. You're not alone in your struggle. You're not alone in your crazy mind. You're not alone in hardship. You're not alone. You know what I mean? We're not alone. We are all this basically the same, and we're all dealing with the same stuff in this world. And I found that community, for me, it's been such a great place to go and to feel, again, seen, you know, and to just connect with other open-hearted people who also want to add more love and compassion and kindness to our world, to recognize that there's a lot of ugliness and darkness and shit out there, but that we can show up from a place of love and that we're right, affecting our world positively every time we do so.
Absolutely. And you're a hell of a messenger, Scott.
Oh, thank you, man. Yeah. I appreciate it. You both too. Thank you for what you're doing. You're shining light, lots of light.
We shine something.
Well, David, you and I are shining more light thanks to our bald head. We reflect light. We
reflect light into the world.
Literally.
Quite literally.
If somebody asks me a question, I go down and reflect into the heart off my head. They're like, oh, I get it.
See the light.
I know.
If you haven't yet, big love, great book. It's got so much love in it. And as do you, Scott, thank you so much for being here, sharing with us. We really appreciate it. And
my pleasure.
I think we're going to have to all hang out sometime. I think we're going to cross paths in the
physical. I have a feeling we are too. Yeah.
I think so.
I felt that within minutes of talking to you too. So yeah, I look forward to it whenever it happens. And thank you so much for having me on your beautiful show.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you
for listening. See you next time.
Hey, everybody, that's Scott Stabile. I hope you enjoyed the show as much as we enjoyed the interview. After we recorded the show, Scott said he had never laughed so much in an interview. And of course, that's the way we like it. So total success. Awesome, David.
Yeah, great guy. And damn it, the tragedy he's been through and come out the other side of is unfathomable. He's got a heart of gold. He's a wonderful writer. And he's got Elizabeth Gilbert has his back. So,
he's all good.
He's good. If you want to find Scott, it's Scott Stabile, STABILE.com. And his Facebook page is off the hook. He's got a lot of people coming through there and he shares a lot of great content. So, check that out as well. Big Love is the book. You can get it on Amazon or anywhere else. And wish him the best in his teaching and all really wonderful work and light he's bringing to this planet. So thank you, Scott. And for all you listeners who come and hang with me and Cody every few weeks, if you don't know yet, we are putting all of these up on YouTube now. So we actually have a video cast of us interviewing Scott. So if you're listening to this by audio and you want to see it, you go to our website, you'll find it there, or YouTube. And we just published our Awakening to Energy series recently that Cody and I taught. So if you weren't there live, but you'd like to be a part of it, that's also on the site. It's a wrap. Thank you all so much for listening. As always, keep meditating, enjoy yourselves. Don't be too serious. Forgive well and love deeply. See you next time.
See you next time, everybody.
You've been listening to the Energy Matters podcast with Cody Edner and David Gandelman. Brought to you by intuitivevision.net and groundedmind.com. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or soundcloud.com.